Zuerst einmal vielen herzlichen Dank für die Einladung nach Berlin. Es ist ein Ehre. Wir wissen immer über Wohlstand ohne Wachstum, Prosperity without growth.
Und ein Vergnügen zu sehen, dass diese Ideen in Deutschland ernst genommen werden. Ich entschuldige mich gleich, dass ich mein Deutsch nicht über den Abend halten werde. Aber glauben Sie mir, wir werden uns auf Englisch viel besser verstehen. Thank you all the same. Is this the moment perhaps for me to admit that I am slightly claustrophobic and to seek an escape from something which is now becoming a sort of phenomenon. Rooms full of people hungry for a conversation that only 2 years ago we were told we could not have. In fact, when the Commission first introduced the idea that it was going to talk about economic growth, the Treasury spokesman got up in the room and said, "Now I see what sustainability is all about. It's about going back to live in caves." And that visceral reaction, that reaction of the politician against even questioning growth, was actually profoundly influential in the way that I developed the thesis in Prosperity Without Growth. But before I explore a little bit of that, let me tell you about how Treasury came back into the story after the report was published, indeed after the book was republished, and after the Financial Times, very strangely, had put it on their Books of the Year list. It suddenly became a conversation where the British Treasury said, perhaps we should get this guy, this Tim Jackson, back into Treasury and get him to talk to us about the ideas in the book. So I willingly accepted. And when I got to the room, what did I find? Actually, interestingly, I found standing room only. Before you get too excited, though, I should confess there were only 8 chairs in that room. Presumably, the Treasury believed that the market for chairs would somehow match supply with demand. And unfortunately, their economic model failed on that occasion to give people Wohlstand, although it gave them, of course, a lot of very interesting ideas, which they promptly forgot. My hope is, of course, though, that what I see here and what I've seen in so many rooms, actually, is a real appetite for what could turn out to be the most important conversation of our times. And as both Barbara and Christina reminded us, this is not a new conversation. It is something that has a long pedigree, that was talked about in the 1970s. And one of the strangest experiences I had after Prosperity Without Growth was launched was, well, actually, on the evening in which it was launched, I had an experience that made me think I had done something rather foolish. I had a phone call, in fact, from an unnamed official in an unnamed department telling me that number 10 in an unnamed street in London had gone ballistic. And in fact, suddenly having realised that its own commission was about to publish a report on prosperity without growth, they got very, very cold feet, that they in fact were furious. Anger, personal anger, was directed both at the commission and at myself. And I began to wonder if this was the career path that my parents had foreseen for me. But it was, in spite of that, instructive to me that this visceral response of policy to the questioning of growth was there. And I began to see, in fact, through that visceral questioning, that this is, and perhaps it is the only thing that Prosperity Without Growth brings to the debate that is different and that is new, that we have to approach this as a very, very profound dilemma. If it were easy to dismantle growth, then surely the Green Party from 30, 40 years ago would have been listened to. If it were easy to dismantle growth, then we would have met our climate change targets. We would have addressed the problem of resource scarcity. We would have halted the loss of biodiversity, seeing how plainly our growth-based model was leading to unsustainability. And the real crux issue here is that We know those things. We know that this growth model is unsustainable. Politicians know that it's unsustainable. Politicians have quite legitimate social and ecological objectives that they aspire to, that they achieve, that they put legislation down in order to achieve. And they understand that the demands of curbing the excesses of materialistic growth are ones that have an increasingly urgent timescale. And yet, in spite of these realizations, the obvious demands of the environment, in spite of the challenge of climate change and the prospect of resource scarcity, questioning growth is still the most difficult thing to do. And the reason it's such a difficult thing to do is a part of this dilemma. A dilemma has two horns. If the first horn is that growth is unsustainable, then the second horn is that degrowth, a non-growing economy, personally I prefer the French term décroissance, which sounds vaguely appetizing, something you might want for breakfast. But actually, décroissance, degrowth, the paradox is, the dilemma is, that degrowth is unstable. We do not know how to make economies work when they're not growing. That's the reality. And that reality is brought home to us, was brought home to us during the recession, during the financial crisis. It's been brought home to us over the years that actually our economics is built very specifically around an idea of consumption growth. Our investment is structured to invest in productive assets, to expand consumer markets. And that expansion of consumer markets around new, exciting consumer products has, as it turns out, a perfect counterpart in us, in people, because we love new stuff. Actually, we are implicated in our own consumption patterns, in our own daily lives. We use material things as a language of goods. We use it to tell each other stories about how important we are, about how much we love each other, about how much we fit in society. We use it to strengthen our identity, to pursue our social links, to have and create a sense of meaning in our lives. And this is the profundity of the dilemma. This is the place where we are implicated in an economic structure, a social logic that says simply removing growth from the equation is not, at this point, a policy option. So I think it's, in fact, important up to a point to forgive politicians. Not all of them, obviously. Some of them are clearly culpable and with no good intent whatsoever, the present company excepted. But it is, nonetheless, I think, a dilemma that makes very clear to us that policymakers, that government itself, is caught in this trap. It is caught in the dilemma of growth. Just as politicians have a legitimate duty to defend social and ecological goals, so they also have a legitimate duty to protect social stability. And if social stability depends on economic stability, and economic stability depends on economic growth, then it's no surprise to find politicians continually returning to economic growth as their one and only ground truth. This is their point of reference. This is how they know about achieving social stability. This is how they know about achieving electoral support. This is how they know to make public spending work. This is how they know as the basis of taxation. And this structure, the entire structure of government itself, is locked, therefore, is conflicted, deeply conflicted, knowing that growth as we have it is unsustainable, but understanding in visceral terms that to take away growth actually is to risk social instability. So that's the profundity of the dilemma. Now, it's legitimate to ask the question, what is in the political mind the response to this dilemma? And it's already been referred to. It is basically this idea of decoupling. The possibility, indeed, the likelihood, because we live in a capitalist economy, that we will do things more efficiently, that we will achieve technological innovations. All this innovation must be good for something, and one of the things it's very good for actually is doing things more efficiently. So low carbon technologies, energy efficiencies, resource productivities, these are advances that we need in the transition to a sustainable economy. And the hope of those who would escape from the dilemma of growth is that decoupling is good enough. We are clever enough. We have enough good technologies that we can keep growth going, economic value can keep on increasing, but our resource throughput, our environmental impacts can all decline because of this idea of decoupling. We can decouple our economies from the damaging impacts they have on the environment. Now, this is a very powerful idea. It's not one that I object to in principle. It is absolutely essential to decouple economic activity from its resource and environmental impact. But the question, well, two questions really. Have we actually ever achieved it? Have we done it in history? Have we achieved any absolute decoupling over material resources in the expansion of our economies? And the paradox here is that we've done lots of efficiency saving. We've done lots of efficiency measures. The decline in the energy intensity of the economy over the last 3 to 4 decades has been around a third. And yet over that same period, carbon emissions have increased by 40%. So what is going on here? What is the dynamics of this system? This is a system, an economy that prizes efficiency, that likes to reduce its input costs because that actually maximizes its revenues. It's a system in which technological innovation delivers us efficiency improvements, but in the same token, it expands the demand of the economy as a whole. Consumption itself hasn't stopped. The demand for consumer goods hasn't stopped. And scale, the sheer scale of economic activity at the global level, simply outweighs efficiency time and time again. It's like trying to run up the down escalator. And the faster you run, the faster the escalator is moving downwards. It's like the Red Queen in Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, running faster and faster to keep up with those who are also running faster and faster because they're also trying to keep up. We're implicated in technological processes, in economic institutions, and in a social logic where the expansion of consumption, the expansion of demand, simply overwhelms the best of our technological efforts. And it is a slightly complex argument. I'm often accused, particularly by the technological optimists, of simply downplaying technological possibility. One of my examples points to the speed with which we would have to decarbonize our economies if we were, for example, to achieve an equitable world of 9 billion people in 2050, all aspiring to Western incomes, with those incomes still growing at 2% per year and trying to meet our carbon targets. And the numbers are heroic. It turns out that we need to reduce the carbon intensity of activity something like 130-fold, at least 10 times faster than anything we've ever done in the entirety of industrial history. And beyond that period, we have to reduce the carbon intensity of the economy even further because it's still growing. And by the end of the century, we need an economy that is pulling carbon out of the atmosphere rather than pushing carbon into the atmosphere. It is a huge, almost magical sense of wishful thinking about the ability of technology. But interestingly, my argument here is that this may well be possible. This may well be technologically possible. There may be carbon-reducing technologies that we could implement at that kind of speed. But my question is not whether it's technologically possible, but whether it's possible in this kind of society, with these kinds of economic institutions, with these kinds of economic structures, and with this social logic in which we are so deeply implicated, not just in arbitrary, abstract economic consumption, but actually in a material language of goods, a continual status-driven competition evolving and revolving around stuff, around things, around experiences, around mobility, around travel, around our aspirations for a better life for our children, around our sense of meaning and purpose in our lives, cashed out, quite literally in some sense, through income and the possession of material goods. It's this dynamic that makes decoupling unrealistic, not technological possibility, but the structure and nature of society itself. And this is a system in which neither government nor business nor people, individuals, are entirely free. In fact, if as a consumer you want to get off the treadmill, if you want to decide not to consume, there's a myriad of signals trying to persuade you back into consumption. And so at the point of recession, for example, when the instinct of people is not to consume, to concentrate on necessity, to forgo luxury, to save instead of to spend, the job of the politician is to persuade them not to, is to ask them to go against their own instincts. Keynes called this the paradox of thrift. The worst thing to do in a recession, from conventional economic terms, is to save, because in saving you slow down the recovery. And this is a point, therefore, where we begin to see that rather than the economic system serving the real needs of people, it's much more about the creation of people as consumers simply to keep the economic system going. There's a quote that very quickly did the rounds in Twitter, which I've said so many times in English that I balk at saying it again, so I thought I might try it in German. And it goes something like this. Es ist eine Geschichte über uns, über Leute, die dazu gebracht werden, Geld auszugeben, das sie nicht haben. Für Dinge, die sie nicht brauchen. Um Eindruck zu machen, der nicht hält, auf Leute, die sie nicht mögen. And this is the... Thank you for that. It is one of those very strange incidences where you say something from the top of your head, it strikes a chord, and then wherever you go, people either chastise you for not saying it or tell you that you said it before. But now there is a version of it in German coming from my lips, and you applauded. Thank you so much for that. I don't want to spend a lot of time on the book itself and the prescriptions in the book. Suffice it to say here, it is much better, I think, to get onto the discussion, but let me just indicate where, for me, the avenues of exploration lie. I think, firstly, they lie in identifying the profound misunderstanding that sits at the heart of economics. And it's a profound understanding about human nature. It's a sense of human nature which suggests that we are entirely selfish, individualistic, hedonistic, novelty-seeking consumers. And it's a convenient view of human nature because that's who we would like to have to keep this growth-based system going. But actually, as my example of the recession shows, as anybody's individual experience shows, it's not an accurate reflection of who we are. We all know that the selfish tendency is balanced by an altruistic tendency. Social psychology even tells us there's an evolutionary basis for this tension in the psyche. Selfish behaviours only work under certain evolutionary conditions. And it was, in fact, the altruistic behaviours, the social behaviours, that were fundamental to the success of the human species. We are not selfish individualists. We are predominantly social beings. And likewise, social psychology points to a tension between novelty-seeking, this hedonistic, pleasure-seeking person, who I know from personal experience lives here inside me, as it does probably in many of you, but is balanced in our natures by a conservationist, a traditionalist perspective that seeks the stability of the long term. And when you see this, when you see it from social psychology, when you see the evidence in practice, when you know its truth from the wisdom of religious traditions and wisdom faiths for eons and you seek in your own experience the examples of it, you suddenly see also, I think, where this profound mistake in economics comes from. It comes from privileging one small part of the human psyche and believing that this is what human nature is about. It's not. Social psychology tells us it's not. Wisdom tells us it's not. And our task here becomes clearer as well, because instead of building institutions based on the assumption that what we need to do is incentivize those selfish novelty-seeking behaviors, we open up a new realm of possibility, a set of institutions that recognize the tension between selfish and other regarding behaviors, that recognize the tension between novelty-seeking and traditional behaviors, institutions that lengthen our time horizons, that reduce our sense of a fast financial return on investment, that seek a longer, more embedded perspective in which returns flow to the community, in which ecological returns and social returns are measured and valued with equal importance to financial returns. Is it possible to devise these institutions? The extraordinary thing is they're already being devised. There is what I've called in the book a kind of Cinderella economy, a set of often small-scale, often local activities with explicitly social goals at their heart, structured in different ways, with different legal forms, offering real valuable services to people in health, in education, in social care, in renovation and refurbishment, in the protection of ecological assets, in leisure and recreation, a set of activities that protects our social spaces and offers us real public goods, places where we have the possibility to flourish as human beings, to prosper, but in less materialistic ways. Do these things already exist? Yes, in embryonic form. But I'm not, of course, arguing that we can achieve this kind of change without political leadership. The needs of policy are huge. The engagement of policymakers is critical. But the centre, the centrepiece of that exploration has to be an openness to two things. One is the profundity of the dilemma that we face and the willingness to engage in that conversation. And the other is a real and meaningful sense of what prosperity actually consists in. Wohlstand. In jeder sinnvollen Verwendung des Wortes geht über materielle Bedürfnisse weit hinaus. Wohlstand liegt doch vor allem in unserer Liebe vor unseren Familien, in der Unterstützung unserer Freunde, in der Stärke unserer sozialen Gemeinschaften, in unserer Fähigkeit zur echten Teilhabe am gesellschaftlichen Leben, eine Ahnung von Sinn und Zweck unseres Lebens zu kreieren und zu erhalten. Die Herausforderung für unsere Gesellschaft ist es, Konditionen zu schaffen, die das möglich machen werden. Thank you very much for your attention.